Thank you so much, Nick, for that lovely introduction. It's been such a pleasure to be part of the Generation to Reproduction project. I've learned so much by being embedded in a group of scholars who are devoted to thinking about reproduction in new ways. So as Nick said, with the arrival any few weeks from now of the son or daughter of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, many of us have been reminded of other royal births in the past, and in this lecture series, we're exploring how we might think about them and what we might learn. Now, as Nick said, my first book was on healthcare for the poor. I'm not really a natural to opine about royalty. I'm usually more comfortable at the other end of the social spectrum. But from a historian's perspective, there's nothing like a royal birth because they're so well documented, completely unlike births at the other end of the social scale. So when I began working on this royal birth, I was just blown away by the sheer number of sources I had available to me. So this evening, I'm going to tell the story of the media circus known as the warming pan baby, called that because supposedly the birth of this heir to the throne was smuggled into the birthing room in a warming pan. I assume some of you had this story at school, but some of you didn't, so I will tell the story in case you didn't get the details. This is at the heart of an event long considered central to English history, the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, a triumph of Whig principles which, according to the traditional narrative, cemented the nation's constitutional monarchy and undergirded subsequent unprecedented economic and imperial development. So that's the traditional story. As a historian of the body, I'm interested in the ways that the maternal reproductive body is at the heart of this particular tale. While William of Orange may have won the nation when he landed at Torbay with a huge army in 1688, in reality, the battle had already been fought and won. In the pages and pages of cheap print propaganda that told and retold the story of the warming pan baby, many of those are the sources that I'll be using tonight that you'll see in my slides. This story was told as evidence that James II was utterly unfit to rule because he had permitted the substitution of a supposititious heir in the birthing room. So James sneaked away to France, and the nation welcomed William and Mary as their new king and queen. Now, obviously, a royal birth like this is different to that of an ordinary mother. But as I hope to show you, when we look more closely at the warming pan baby story, we can see that there are many aspects of it that look surprisingly ordinary, and that much of the way the story was told depended upon larger beliefs about gender relations and the nature of female sexuality. My story tonight is also one of tangled family relations. Here's three of our main actors, the three eldest children of Charles I. That's Charles in the fancy gold silk suit. In between him and his sister Mary is James. I know he looks like a girl in this picture, he just hasn't been breached yet. From the ages of the children, I'm pretty sure this must be around 1642 or 1643. So this is three of our main actors. My story begins, however, with a tale of a passionate affair. Anne, the daughter of Sir Edward Hyde, one of Charles II's main advisors while he was in exile during the interregnum. His daughter Anne became lady-in-waiting to Mary, then Mary of Orange, that's the little girl on that side. And Charles and James were mostly in Brussels at that point, and they used to go to the Netherlands to visit their sister, Mary of Orange, frequently. And on one of those occasions, Anne Hyde, the lady-in-waiting, and James, Duke of York, fell in love. Early in 1660, Anne found that she was pregnant. James and Anne had a marriage contract. Brother Charles was extremely upset by this underhanded behavior. This was not what he had in mind. But the secret marriage contract held, and the two were married. A month later, Anne gave birth. Oh, they did get married, but it was secretly. A month later, she gave birth to their son, Charles. He was made Duke of Cambridge. He died the following year. While she was in labor, remember, the marriage is secret. Nobody knows that they're married. Anne was interrogated as to who the father of her child actually was. This practice was common for an unwed mother in labor when the parish was concerned about who was going to pay child support. And so the midwife was instructed by the parish authorities to interrogate a mother in labor to find out who the father actually was, because the parish wanted to get child support. Otherwise, the parish was going to have to pay for the baby born within the parish limits for well over a decade. It was thought that a woman in labor would not dare to lie about this because either she was so close to death, like she could die in labor, so she would be bound to tell the truth, she's about to meet her maker, or more darkly, that the pains of labor were like torture, and torture extracted truth, and so she would speak the truth. Now, it's true that women of Anne Hyde's class were not usually in this position, but an absolutely standard procedure, that of the midwife interrogating the woman in labor, was used in this case. She insisted the father was indeed James, and shortly thereafter, after the birth, James, Duke of York, admitted that it was his child and claimed paternity. Again, the brother Charles didn't like it, but he was convinced that the secret marriage was actually legal and he couldn't bust it up, and so he stood by it. Besides, Charles at that point had other fish to fry. It was 1660, it was becoming clear that he would be restored to the throne, and he was negotiating a marriage with that's young, handsome James that she fell in love with. That's the happy couple in the 1660s. And there's Catherine of Braganza, who is, this is the bride-to-be of Charles II. He's negotiating to marry her. So he must have believed at that point he would have a legitimate heir, a couple of sons maybe even, and that he didn't really have to worry about his brother's irregular marriage. And indeed, in 1660, as you all know, he was restored to the throne. Here's a ballad celebrating that fact. It shows us all six of Charles I's children. The third son doesn't live much longer, but certainly a good crew of potential heirs there. So in the early 1660s, it seems like this irregular marriage doesn't really matter too much. In 1663, Samuel Pepys noted how very devoted James and Anne were. He said, "With the kissing of hands and leaning in on one another." I can see he doesn't think it's appropriate behavior. Anne went on to have eight children. Only two of them survived childhood. This painting looks a lot like the one I just showed you. That's because it's a knockoff. It's a copy of the other one with Windsor Castle painted in the background and the two little girls added in. These are Mary and Anne, each of whom will go on to rule England as queen. Anne, Duchess of York, died in 1671 with her husband James at her side, probably from breast cancer, having had eight children in 11 years. Meanwhile, by 1671, things weren't looking too good for Charles and Catherine. Charles II was well known for fathering bastards, but over time it was becoming clear he couldn't seem to get a legitimate heir with his wife, much the same story Peter Jones told last week about Henry VIII. Plenty of illegitimate sons, but can't manage to get that legitimate one. Charles was very fond of his illegitimate children. For example, making James Scott, that's the son of Lucy Walters, into the Duke of Monmouth. His child with the Countess of Castlemaine becomes another duke. That's Barbara Villiers, then Castlemaine, and then Nell Gwynn, each of those sons becomes a duke. And if you think all of these women look sort of alike, they're all painted by Peter Lely except for Barbara Villiers. And it seems like that was part of the mistress package that you got painted by Peter Lely. And there is at least one painting where the experts can't decide which mistress it actually was. He made them look all alike. So he was very fond. Everybody knew all these young dukes are at court. Everyone knows that he can father sons, but they're not legitimate. He was totally unashamed of having illegitimate children. Charles is supposed to have joked about his train of bastards. When someone referred to him kind of piously as the father of his country, he quipped, "I believe I am, of a good number of them." But as I said, by the 1670s, things aren't looking so good. It's becoming clear that Charles is probably not going to have a legitimate heir. His wife Catherine's uterine difficulties are the stuff of court gossip. We know about them because ambassadors wrote to their masters back home in other countries about her difficulties. So it's becoming imperative for James, the brother, to remarry after Anne dies and somehow get an heir to the throne. Here's Mary of Modena, born Maria Beatrice d'Este, daughter of the Duke of Modena. She grew up assuming and wanting to be a nun. She assumed her future was in the convent. All that changed when James needed a new bride and an heir. The Earl of Peterborough came to call. She told him, frankly, she was going to the convent. You know, this is not for me. But when her uncle consented to the advantageous marriage, she supposedly cried for days. In September 1673, she was married in Modena with the Earl of Peterborough standing proxy for James II. So she's marrying a man she has never met. And then they set off for England 2 months later on her, they set off on her 15th birthday. 2 months later, they land in Dover. James was on the beach to meet her. When Mary Beatrice, and I'm going to call her Mary Beatrice because there's so many Marys in my story. In fact, there's so many Queen Marys in my story, it can be hard to tell who I'm talking about. So it sounds sort of, you know, all cozy royal gossip-ish, but I will call her Mary Beatrice so we know who I'm talking about. When she visited Cambridge in 1680, she was considered to be very handsome, gracious-looking person, pretty tall. This is Samuel Newton speaking. Pretty tall, not very big, black-eyed, something pale-faced, a little outlandish-like swarthy color, he wrote. Initially, everything seemed to go well. The couple seemed to get along okay. Mary Beatrice even made a good stepmother to those two little girls, Mary and Anne. Mary, after all, was 11, more like a younger sister to Mary Beatrice than like a daughter, perhaps. Mary Beatrice's reproductive history, however, proved to be problematic. This is a portrait from 1680. I think it may allude to her hopes for fertility. The metaphor of flowers followed by fruit is very common in this period. It's one of the most common ways people talk about reproduction. And you'll see this flower is suggestively placed right where her womb would be. So I think this is a kind of subtle hint that that's what they're hoping for. But things did not go too terribly well. She miscarried in May 1674 and got pregnant again almost instantly, giving birth to her daughter Katharina in January 1675. Got pregnant immediately thereafter and miscarried in May. If you're counting, that's sort of, she has three pregnancies in a calendar year or parts of pregnancies. That's almost impossible biologically. And she's all of 16 or so. But once again, she gets pregnant almost immediately, only to have the double tragedy of losing her infant daughter Katharina in October 1675 and miscarrying the following day. Once again, the baby machine was revved up with all speed, and Mary gave birth to her daughter Isabella in August 1676, and to the long-awaited son the following November. He was named Charles and became Duke of Cambridge. Had this baby boy not died at 5 weeks of age, our story would be very different. So she's desperately trying to have the heir to the throne. And then a family event impinges on what's going on. Her stepdaughter Mary married William, the clever, taciturn stadtholder of Orange in the Netherlands. They're first cousins. Here's a picture of them as children. They're not betrothed. They just are first cousins at this point. Stepmother and stepdaughter remained on very good terms. Indeed, all the way until William set sail for England, Mary Beatrice and Mary of Orange were exchanging happy family letters, with Mary Beatrice telling her about the ongoing pregnancy, etc. It seems it was Mary's sister Anne who had always been suspicious and really sowed the seeds of discord. In fact, Mary Beatrice writes to William of Orange as her son. He's older than she is, but technically he's her stepson once he's married, or her stepson-in-law. And she writes letters to him, rather naive letters addressed to my dear son. Politically, this couple, William and Mary, begin to look like an appealing alternate heir to the English throne if neither Charles nor the openly Catholic James succeed in producing an heir, which neither of them had yet done. William had a strong claim to the throne of his own. He was, after all, descended from, he was married to a descendant of Charles I, Mary, that I showed you in the opening slide. So he is both first cousins to the woman he marries, he is the son-in-law and nephew of Charles and James. By November 1681, Mary Beatrice was pregnant again, almost miscarried a month later after a riding accident, and then had her daughter Charlotte in August 1682. Charlotte, however, died at 3 months. Mary suffered two more miscarriages in 1683 and 1684. Then in February 1685, King Charles dies after a sudden illness. Here's a ballad lamenting his loss. He converted to Catholicism on his deathbed. The openly Catholic James, Duke of York, becomes James II. Initially, things seem to go well. When Charles's bastard son, the Duke of Monmouth, stages an invasion in the West Country, trying to take over the throne for himself, Parliament quickly funds James II to put down the rebellion, which was done speedily and brutally. And initially, compared to his brother Charles, James seemed like a kind of diligent, even hardworking king. And he, you know, stuck with the job. But he was immensely politically naive, seemingly tone deaf to the all too obvious consequences of his vehement pro-Catholic policies. If he tried to find ways to upset people, and to alienate various political constituencies he could not have chosen better ways. Ostentatiously building Catholic places of worship in London, welcoming communities of monks to live and work in London. People hadn't seen monks walking the streets for, you know, a century. And London, as I'll say in a minute, is England is vehemently anti-Catholic. Putting a Jesuit on the Privy Council, not a smart move. Revoking city charters in order to put men in parliament that are more favorable to his religious beliefs. Trying to purge army and navy officers. Arresting the so-called seven bishops who would not bend to his will, thus instantly making them national heroes. These and many more. The word naive can't really contain just how ignorant he was of the consequences of his actions. It was folly. Battle lines were beginning to be drawn, and some of England's political leaders began to secretly get in touch with William of Orange, sounding him out to see what might be possible and if somehow he might be able to return England to a proper Protestant monarchy. So when the Queen announced she was pregnant in late 1687, it was like dropping a match into a powder keg. For James and Mary Beatrice, however, it must have seemed like their prayers had been answered, because James is supposed to have gone to pray at a holy well. This is the shrine of St. Winifred in Flintshire. It's about the only holy well that makes it through the Reformation. It's sort of protected locally. So he goes there to pray for an heir. Mary Beatrice went the secular route. She went to Bath and took the waters in an attempt to strengthen her body. So for them, it must have looked like all these efforts were paying off. She was pregnant again. Here she is right around that time. On the 9th of June, 1688, she stayed up late playing cards and returned to the palace of St. James to sleep. She went into labor the next morning. The baby had not been expected for another fortnight, and so all of a sudden there's a lot of rushing around at the palace trying to get things ready, made worse by the fact the palace was still being renovated. So it was kind of a difficult situation. At least 30 people crowded into the room, including the king, Lord Peterborough, and the Lord Chancellor. Just before 10 a.m., a baby boy was born to be named James Francis Stuart, and here's a broadside celebrating his arrival. Most of these men were strangers to a birthing room, and neither Mary Beatrice nor the men themselves, as I'll explain further, felt really comfortable with their presence there. Lord Peterborough, remember, he's the one who was proxily married by proxy to her, Lord Peterborough stuffed his fingers in his ears when the Queen cried out in labor pains. Now, you may be wondering how I know that Peterborough stuck his fingers in his ears. How would I know that? That's because of another political fumble on the part of James. As I'll say more about, all summer long, an incredible array of rumors, stories, gossip is circulating about the birth of this prince. Is it the real prince? Is it a fake? Many stories. I'll tell you more in a minute. So finally, James realizes he has to do something, that these stories are getting out of hand. He calls a court of inquiry that met until the 22nd of October. By this point, William's fleet had already been assembled. It was, I'm afraid, another political miscalculation, because when this court of inquiries results were published, it just provided more fodder for gossip. One of my favorite versions of the testimony is this one, and what it does, this is the testimony that's been republished by the opposition, because what it does is it says, those marked with this asterisk were Roman Catholics. So it goes through the testimony and puts little stars next to everybody whom you shouldn't believe, because they couldn't possibly be trustworthy because they were Catholic. So Mary Crane, who's lady of the household to the Dowager Queen, Isabella Waldegrave, lady of the household to the Queen herself, they have little stars next to their names here that shows you shouldn't really be listening to them. So this document shows us that 42 people testified, of whom 34 had actually been in the birth chamber. Of those 42, 19 were Catholics. William had already set sail in the Netherlands on October 17th. He was hammered by a gale, had to go back to shore. On November 1st, he set sail again. This time, he's aided by that famous so-called Protestant wind that enables him to sail right to the south the south coast of England, while the English navy is kept close to shore in the mouth of the Thames by that same wind. They literally see the fleet sail by, and there's nothing that they can do. Then on November 5th, an auspicious date, the wind turns again, and William of Orange is able to land at Torbay. It looked as if the wind might have actually pushed him so far he couldn't have even landed in England, but he gets lucky again, the wind turns, and he lands. His month-long progress towards London was almost completely unopposed, except by what sounds like buckets of mud in the thin, tiny Devon lanes. He moves forward with this massive army almost completely unopposed. James suddenly came to realize just what a mess he was really in. The Queen fled Whitehall before dawn on the morning of the 10th of December after having been roused from the King's bed. She was supposedly disguised as a laundry woman, taking her baby son to a yacht off of Gravesend. They sailed to Calais and then headed for Paris, where she was welcomed by, oh, sorry, there's the Prince of Orange welcome to London, a little propaganda for you. She's welcomed by none other than Louis XIV, who offered her the Palace of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. That's where she lived for the rest of her life. James joined her there, having been captured in a boat on the Thames, attempting to throw the Great Seal into the river. It's pretty clear he was purposely allowed to escape, because from the opposition's perspective, a king in jail wasn't much use to them. They certainly didn't want to execute him like his father. But if he left and left the throne vacant, then they had plenty of room for maneuver. So it looks like he was, you know, let to escape. Saint-Germain may not have been all that terrible for Mary Beatrice. Here she is in about 1690 with her infant son, James Francis, who's the one who becomes known as the Old Pretender. She and James were honored guests. They were treated as monarchs, and they were at the showiest court in Europe. It was not that hard of a life. Louis had always liked Mary Beatrice, and he treated her very well. She had another child, a daughter, who didn't live past infancy. James dies around 1703. Mary Beatrice dies in 1718 after a decade-long fight with breast cancer, just like James's first wife, actually. Now, undoubtedly, James's political ineptitude created some of the circumstances where in 3 years he went from welcomed new king to fugitive on the continent. But his ineptitude was amplified into a propaganda storm by at least three things. First of all, as you've already intimated, none of my story would have happened had England not been so rabidly anti-Catholic, a prejudice often mobilized by the people who were becoming the emergent Whig Party. For example, the Green Ribbon Club supported huge Pope-burning processions in London in the late 1670s and 1680s. Now, burning the Pope in effigy had been an English pastime for some while. This is not new, but this scale is new. After the Popish plot, a convoluted, messy, trumped-up plot, they did this parade towards burning the Pope, which shows, it enacts the different parts of the Popish plot on floats. That's what you see going along. So it's as if you have a kind of cartoon version of all the reasons that you shouldn't trust Catholics. Tens of thousands of Londoners turned out to see this kind of stuff. It was really exciting. And of course, many more consume it in print form like this. This is relatively cheap. It's almost impossible to overestimate the power of this sort of racism in mobilizing opposition to the monarch. Second, these kinds of prejudices were amplified by a feisty popular press. Various lapses in licensing during the Civil War and thereafter had made the publication of news items and short topical broadsides boom. The government keeps trying to get control. They keep trying to find ways of controlling this. You'll see many things that have to have approval. You'll see many techniques. But basically, they couldn't put the genie back in the bottle. They could not fully regulate the press again. I have to say right now that I'm showing you various items of propaganda. We don't fully understand how many of the kinds of cheap print stories I'm showing you about the warming pan baby were literally produced as propaganda by the opposition, and how many of them were produced by publishers and printers who knew a good thing, who wanted to, you know, make some fast money off topical news. We can't parse those two, but it's clear both are going on. Third is the new institution of the coffee house. The first English coffee house is in London in 1652. At that point, coffee is a new drink for the British, for the English. By 1660, we think that there were at least 500 coffee houses in London. We can't really know because the Great Fire, we can't actually count how many, but certainly in the hundreds. Coffee houses admitted anyone who laid down a penny at the bar or a token. These are the Starbucks cards of the 1660s. You bought a token for a penny, and then you could drink coffee. More important for my story, you could read newspapers in cheap print. These places had plenty of things for you to read right there. Coffee houses were known for political talk. They were incubators of rumor and gossip. Here's a 16, oh, that's what a coffee house looks like. And there they are sitting around talking and telling jokes. Again, the government knows that this is trouble. They're trying to clamp down on this as best as they can. This is a 1682 edict in which they're trying to stop people from selling cheap print outside of coffee houses around the Royal Exchange. They say they're must pestered with a sort of loose and idle people called hawkers who do daily publish, cry, and sell seditious books, scurrilous pamphlets, and scandalous printed papers. Again, this is blowing in the wind. It doesn't work. They can't actually stop the flow of information. It's a losing battle. So I don't think that the story I'm telling could have happened a century before, because this kind of print was not so widely circulated a century before. The media circus around the birth of James Francis Stewart, the Old Pretender, was not one uniform story. It was actually really interesting. You couldn't actually scotch the rumor because it was a many-headed monster. So once you had, even if you'd managed to say one story was untrue, there were 10 other stories right away. You couldn't actually prove that anything was wrong. The simplest story had the substitution story of a different baby smuggled into the birthing room in a warming pan. Here's a warming pan from the 17th century. Ironically, this has Charles I around the outside. It's actually a kind of royalist decorated thing from the first half of the century. It should have a long handle because you put hot coals in there. It's like what you have before you have hot water bottles. You warm up a bed with it. Now, recent experience, as in earlier this month, may tell us why in an English June you might want one of these. But let's also remember the palace was being renovated, the bedding hadn't been aired, it was cold and damp, so a good reason to have one of these. And various people testified that they felt it and it was really warm, there couldn't have been a baby inside there. Or maybe other stories have the baby was smuggled in through a secret door. One of my favorites has that there's a special headboard for the bed with a little opening, a little door that opens up, and the pamphlet assures you any joiner in the land can make you one of these. It's like really easy. You can duplicate this device. I love this image. This shows the route supposedly taken. The little dotted lines show how they smuggled a fake prince in there, the baby. For me, this looks like an image from the golden age of detective novels in the 1930s and 1940s. It's like one of those locked room murders, you know, how did Lord so-and-so get killed in the conservatory? But actually, this is from 1688, and it shows how supposedly they smuggled in the fake baby. Yet another version emphasizes that while James was incapable of fathering a child, often they say he's syphilitic, there's no way he could manage that, perhaps the queen did actually have a baby, and the father of the baby was the queen's Jesuit confessor, Father Petrie. Here's a little lullaby song, a rude ballad all about how it's really the Jesuit confessor who's the father. Or worse yet, it might have been the papal nuncio, the papal ambassador, who I'm afraid had the last name Dada. And yes, for real. And so you can just imagine what cheap print did with that. Many different forms and genres of cheap print offered readers stories about the birth of the Prince of Wales. In the time we have today, I can only really give you the tip of the iceberg. It goes on and on. This is one of my favorite sources. It is a deck of cards that tells the entire story. And what's interesting to me about the deck of cards is, first of all, it's serially numbered, so you can follow the story like a cartoon. It's like an early comic book. But also, there isn't full information on the cards. There's a caption, but very often, as I'll show you, you'd have to know about the rumors already to actually make sense of the image. This kind of propaganda, this set of cards, totally places the story as one of the dangerous Catholics and how they have been overcome. The first reference to rumors about the Prince of Wales is number 19. That's a lady going to St. Winifred's Well, but actually, as we know, it's really the king, we think, who went to St. Winifred's Well, but it gives you the Catholic practice. This is not acceptable behavior. Number 17 shows processing the host. They did really do this. Through St. James Park, very inflammatory behavior. And card number 20 depicts a Jesuit preaching against the English Bible. Again, this is really inflammatory kinds of material. Card number 21 is Madam WKS at confession. Here you have to know that Madam W blank KS is Judith Wilkes. That's the Queen's midwife. So you need to bring that to the card to understand that this is telling us the Queen's midwife is Catholic and just how dangerous that might really be. The next image, again, situates the birth in a Catholic context. Here's the card praying to the Lady of Loretto for a Prince of Wales to be born. Mary of Modena did pray to Our Lady for a successful pregnancy. Her mother actually did make a pilgrimage to Loreto to pray for her to have a baby. And many sources, instead of showing this, they show a big payoff. They show lots of money being given to ensure this to happen. It's through cheap print like this, playing cards, ballads, pamphlets, that William's coming was framed as a Protestant rescue mission targeted against a sneaky king who did not respect the law and who would try to subvert proper succession to the throne by substituting a baby not his own. And it was as such, as a triumph of one faith over another, that William's arrival is celebrated. Here we go, England's happiness revived, a farewell to popery. That's what the Glorious Revolution looks like in cheap print. Or this one, Prince of Orange's triumph, the downfall of the distressed Jesuits. So in this kind of source, it's told very much as the fake baby and the triumph of the Protestant faith. Now, I want to shift gears. I could talk all day about this material. It's so rich. There's so much of it. There's so many different stories. But viewed from my perspective as a historian of early modern reproduction, much about this exceptional birth actually seems kind of familiar. Like, oh, I understand this. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. First, it was very difficult to know if a woman were truly pregnant or not. There's no at-home pregnancy tests. There's no doctor's office tests on hapless toads and rabbits. Women themselves declared they were pregnant when they felt the baby move, when they quickened. Only they were able to say. At the very end of December 1687, Mary Beatrice had felt unwell and feared she would miscarry yet again. Her doctors had been dosing her with astringent medicines to help her body hold on to the pregnancy. When she began to feel a little better, she then felt the baby quicken. But she was unsure because she wasn't clear whether she'd conceived in September or in October, so she was a little confused about the dates. She was ridiculed in the popular press for this, for not understanding, because as they pointed out, she'd only slept with the king twice. So she really ought to have known. And in fact, popular medicine would say she should have known that the sexual experience itself would have told her she was pregnant, but she gets in trouble. However, Nicholas Culpepper, the main midwifery author of the period, himself said, women often get this wrong. They often don't understand when they conceived, and therefore they get the date of the expected birth wrong. He said, it's as easy as putting on the wrong shoe in the dark. So, maybe not so different. The trouble with quickening, of course, as a sign of pregnancy, is it's only the woman's word that says. There's no outside. It's not until the invention of the fetal stethoscope in the 19th century that there can be any kind of outward, you know, real knowledge of what's going on. So in the 17th century, when people wanted to know, was she really pregnant? What they did was looked at a woman's breasts. Witness after witness testified in James's hearing, in his special inquiry, that they had seen breast milk leaking out of Mary Beatrice's breasts onto her smock, and that that meant she must have really been, this is before she had the baby, that she must have been pregnant. Here's a 17th century smock. They're a pretty scarce item. They don't survive well. You can see it's a pretty substantial undergarment. This is linen embroidered with silk. And much like some kinds of underwear today, it was actually meant to be seen. Here's those mistresses again, and I've put little arrows by the smock. So you can see this is not necessarily as hidden as you might think it is. Just as the witnesses in this inquiry testified to the presence of milk in Mary Beatrice's breasts, so too did women investigate the breasts of single women whom they thought might be pregnant, or they tried to. In 1666, in a Cumberland village, Isabella Nicholson's family feared the worst, that she was pregnant. Like most young single women, Isabella was in service, living and working in Mary Holmes's house. When Isabella's sister and mother showed up at the Holmes household, the mother, demanding what was become of that whore, her daughter, somehow Mrs. Holmes managed to assure the sister, oh, she's not really pregnant, it's okay. And then she pulled rank on the mother, telling the mother that she wouldn't, you know, who, this is my household and you're not inspecting anybody's breasts in my household. We might wonder, since this actually emerges in a court in a suspected infanticide case, as to what the real story was, but unfortunately we don't know. In 1681, Anne Wright, working in service in Yorkshire, was not so able to avoid scrutiny. Her master, William Wrigglesworth, testified he had seen her swollen breasts tight against her bodice with milk leaking out through her smock. For Mary Beatrice, the smock issue had an added resonance. All the talk of smocks and breast milk, and there was plenty, could not help but remind people of the fact that she had had a smock that was usually on the statue of the Virgin Mary brought to her from Rome. And as you'll see in this picture, it's supposedly brought by Jesuits. Now, she wanted the smock because that's a standard Catholic kind of thing to do to sort of help your body maintain the pregnancy. She wants to have the sanctity of the saint in this material object wrapped around her body. But here, of course, this is the worst kind of papist practice. You don't want to do that. Now, as I said to you, this cheap print never misses the opportunity to push an anti-papist button. But I think it's worth reflecting for a moment that none of Mary Beatrice's practices were unknown to English queens. Before the Reformation, as Peter Jones told us last week, Henry VIII dashed off to the shrine at Walsingham to give thanks to the Virgin Mary after he'd had the long-awaited son, as well as praying to statues of the Virgin to get an heir. When in labor, his mother, Elizabeth of York, had worn a girdle or sash that had been tied around a statue of the Virgin Mary, the exact analog of this garment, just a different garment, same exact practice. We only know about this because she paid the monks who brought it to her the very hefty sum of 6 shillings and 8 pence. Before the late 1530s and the dissolution of monasteries, churches, convents, abbeys, monasteries all over England had girdles associated with the Virgin or other saints to loan out to pregnant women. This was an absolute standard practice. So in that way, some aspects of this birth seem to be not that unusual. Unusual in a Protestant nation, but not unusual when you look at it over the long run. Second, if we read the testimony carefully, there's many aspects of the actual arrival of James Francis Stuart that were the same as many other 17th century births. When a woman went into labor, she summoned her gossips, that's women, friends, neighbors, relatives, to come and support her through labor. In the testimony, we can see how Mary Beatrice did in fact summon the women that she wanted to be there. The testimony starts with women. Now, it's true that of all the witnesses who testified, the highest ranking one is the Dowager Queen, and she goes first. But then it goes through all the other women who were there, down to the laundress. Only then did the men speak, starting with the Lord Chancellor. So it's a very interesting, first all the women speak, and then all the men, and I think that says something about how they understood this occasion. And Countess of Sunderland told the story of how she was called to the birthing room. She'd gone to 8 o'clock service in St. James Chapel, intending to take communion when the chapel attendant tiptoed up and said, "The Queen wants you." She said, "I'll come when the prayers are over." A few minutes later, another servant comes and says, "The Queen's in labor, you have to come right away." So, okay, she dashes off to the bedside. One other lady in waiting was also at the service and came as well. Lady Sophia Bulkeley was still in bed when she was called and made haste to rise and dress so that she managed to get to the bedside in time a little after 9 o'clock. In the rush, no man was sent to Lady Bellasis, but her servant noticed the Dowager Queen's coach in front of St. James Palace and went to inquire. When he found out what was going on, he woke up his mistress right away, who got there just in time for the birth. Some of the satires about the birth claim that she'd never been invited anyway. She just pushed her way in there. Or that she was the queen, the king's mistress, and certainly shouldn't have been there. And what we know from more ordinary births is that women who weren't invited to be there when they thought they should be there were really felt slighted. It's the kind of thing that you see in courts for defamation cases, where women who felt they should have been part of the group took it as a real slight if they were not invited. Frances, Duchess of Richmond, came as soon as she was called, but she got there after the birth. The Countess of Lichfield had a really good excuse because she was in childbed herself, so that's why she didn't make it. All in all, there were 21 women present, 11 of whom were Catholics. The Dowager Queen was there with 3 of her ladies-in-waiting. There were 5 of Mary Beatrice's ladies, 9 other aristocratic women, some of whom are also probably ladies-in-waiting, and 3 servants, the midwife, the future prince's baby nurse, and the laundress. So just like other women, the queen had summoned the women she wanted to be there with her. Now, because she was queen, that was a kind of bigger number of women than usual, but not an exceptional practice. Besides the king, there were 17 men present, only 4 of whom were Catholics. 2 of the men were gentlemen of the household, and another 3 were clearly there to kind of manage things, some kind of managerial capacity. There were 7 officials headed by the Lord Chancellor, the President of the Privy Council, the Lord Privy Seal, etc., were there to witness the birth. Everybody knew that this was a contentious issue, and they wanted to have a lot of witnesses. Very unusually, there were 4 physicians and an apothecary, but no surgeon. When you read the testimony, it's clear just how uncomfortable many of these men were in a birthing room. Men were almost never present at a birth at this time. It was only in cases of dire extremity, when the mother's life was at risk, you might call in a male surgeon to do an incredibly brutal procedure to extract the dead baby piecemeal from the mother to try to save her life. Images of birthing rooms from this period are quite rare, but here's one from about 1700. And you can see it's an all-women gathering, right? That's probably the midwife by the fire. The baby's been swaddled up, he's been washed. All the other women are there to support the mother. These pictures ultimately, I think, come from the genre of the birth of the virgin, like this one. This is from the 15th century. And again, you can see the baby's been washed and swaddled, presented to the new mother. This is a women's room. There's no men present. So men were strangers in a birthing room. You can hear it in their awkward testimony. John, Earl of Mulgrave, prefaced his testimony by saying, "It is not to be expected one of his sex should be able to give full evidence in such a matter." Some of the others come across as just a little bit more seasoned. Sidney Lord Godolphin said the room was so crowded that he was nowhere near the bed, but he heard the queen cry out several times, he said, "as women used to that are in labor." So he thought he knew what was going on. Many of the witnesses comment on how very crowded the room was, but Williamite propaganda restages the event. Here's another playing card. That's the Lord Chancellor being a fool at the very end of the bed, positioning himself in totally the wrong place to see what's going on. He can't see through the bed curtain after all. But we don't see a crowd here. We just see a couple of women. There's no excuse for that foolish Lord Chancellor to be in the wrong place. Another source says that he's an idiot, he's a fool, he's a cuckold, he couldn't be trusted anyway. Newborns were equally unfamiliar to some of the men. The Earl of Middleton noted that the baby, he said, appeared to be very foul, and then added, "he desireth pardon if he do not know the proper expression, but hope his meaning is plain." He knew, he just didn't really know what he was talking about. The Lord Chancellor described the baby as foul, black, and reeking. Now, let's remember, the Lord Chancellor is none other than Hanging Judge Jeffreys, the man who brutally put down the Duke of Monmouth's rebellion. This guy's no wimp, okay? He's seen a lot, but he describes the baby in that way. The women, however, they were used to it. Lady Bulkeley, one of the queen's ladies-in-waiting, explained the prince's face was blackish. She said, "being stunned as I have seen in some other children newly brought into the world." But the prince cleaned up well. And 2 hours later, after he was washed and dressed, she said, "the prince looked very fresh and well." I think there's also a little gendered struggle for authority going on very quietly after the prince was born. The queen wanted to give the baby a little boost and called for a vernacular remedy that I have to say I haven't seen anywhere else, namely a couple of drops of blood from the navel string, that's the umbilical cord, as a strengthening medicine. Dr. Charles Scarborough, the king's physician, distanced himself from this idea, but after all, it was a command from the queen. So here's how he finessed it. He said, after a while, he understood that a medicine was mentioned among ladies for a certain remedy against convulsions. It was some drops of blood from the navel string. So he consults with, of course, he's got 3 other physicians in the room, so he consults with them and says, so to satisfy the women, it was allowed, there being, as it was conceived, no danger in the thing. So he certainly doesn't endorse it, but he'll let them get away with it. So the baby had 3 drops of blood in a little bit of black cherry water, that is to say something like cherry brandy. Midwifery manuals often recommend giving newborns sugar and sack, wine with a little sugar in it, as you would an honored guest, or sometimes a dab of butter and sugar. It's interesting, I've seen other red remedies against convulsions. This is not an unusual thought. I just haven't seen the drops of blood. Same idea. So I've argued that despite some extremely unusual aspects of this birth, in a palace with 34 witnesses, we can see through the testimony that other aspects of the birth were in fact completely ordinary for this time and place. More generally, both of James's wives, Anne and Mary Beatrice, faced the same kinds of daunting odds that all early modern mothers did. Indeed, their wealth seems to have, if anything, been a hindrance, not a help. Out of a total of 16 pregnancies, 12 resulted in a live birth, but only 3 of those 12 made it out of childhood. Figures for infant mortality in England in this period vary from place to place between 250 and 400 per thousand. That is, 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 babies didn't survive infancy. But for Anne and Mary Beatrice, the numbers were much, much worse. If there's time in the question and answer, I can speculate as to why that might have been. I want to close with one last playing card. I'll use it to suggest the story of the warming pan baby has also to be understood in a larger story about gender relations in the Restoration. There he is, that's the infant prince giving audience. And you can hardly see it, But in his hands, he holds a toy. It's a tiny windmill. Initially, I thought this was a little jokey reference to the Protestant wind, but it isn't. It's something else. It's because one of the stories spread about the baby was that his real father was a miller. And so, like breeds like he's playing with the toy that is his real father's, his biological father's workplace. It's no accident, the story has it, that it's a miller. Millers were renowned in ballads for fostering their babies off on other men. Here we have a song called The Buxom Virgin. The Buxom Virgin was made pregnant by one of three millers, we don't know which of the millers, that managed to father the child onto a farmer. The tune to this ballad is known not just as The Buxom Virgin, but also as King James Jig. I think we have to listen to it just because it's called that. I'm sorry about the buzz. Oh, sorry, I don't know what happened there. Let's try that again. I'm so sorry. Oh, there we go. Etc., etc., etc. Obviously, that's not from the 17th century. That's what we think the melody sounded like. That's that kind of song. Or we have Roger the Miller, who sent a present to his cousin Tom the Tailor in London in the shape of a pregnant bride. The choice of the miller, then, as the putative father of the supposititious prince was a clever one. It played on the sexual reputation of millers and provided a handy emblem for illustrations. And it's at all social levels that some of the medals, the much more expensive items, cast to celebrate William Cumming, they also have a windmill in them. So this is an image that goes all the way up the social scale. But more generally, the idea that the buxom virgin was so easily seduced, or that the Queen of England was having it off with the papal nuncio, or with her confessor, or any number of other men, was particularly resonant in the late 17th century. When you look at ballads, broadsides, and other cheap print, you see over and over again that men are the helpless victims of female sexual desires. Any number of Restoration ballads portray a woman who's had sex with many men. She's a temptress, but a comical one. For example, there's the Seven Journeymen Tailors of Yorkshire. It's always tailors that are on the wrong side of this. I don't know if it's the tiny little needles, or if it's that sewing is so female, what it is. The tailors, they're always in trouble. So she's had sex with all seven of the tailors, and they end up in court for child support, and she doesn't know which of the seven tailors it is. So it's a comical situation. The court ends up saying, each of the men is assessed a penny a day for this cost. I have to say that would be the best child support anyone in the 17th century ever got. Or there's the London lass who says, without shame, she says she doesn't know who the father of her child is. So many men I dealt with all, I could not begin to conjecture whether it was some citizen or dejected Hector. Her problem is solved when she goes to a soldier's encampment. And in this wonderful moment of gender inversion, a soldier sees her pregnant belly and blushes. His body, in effect, gives away the fact that he's the father of paternity, and they end up happily wed. These ballads in which women have sex with large numbers of men without shame or even censure point to the larger cultural understanding of women as unable to resist their sexual impulses. No man was safe, but equally, any man could be cuckolded and it wasn't his fault. This is really different to 30 or 40 years earlier when a cuckold was seen as a weak man, an idiot, he should have kept his wife in line. By now, in the Restoration, it's a very different story. Any man could fall prey. This shift, I would argue, and I've argued elsewhere, has to be understood in a larger post-Civil War context in which there's a kind of gender backlash. Women's roles in the Civil War as preachers and protesters, their insistent questioning of gender hierarchies, gets recast in the Restoration as women out of order, as sexually ungovernable and hence completely unfit for any of the political or religious roles they had briefly enjoyed in the world turned upside down. So ultimately, the stories of the warming pan baby, the son of a miller and his wife, the son of a queen and her Jesuit confessor, the story of the Lord Chancellor as an unreliable witness, a cuckold even, all depended upon references to a particular moment in gender relations when all women were sexually suspect. Thank you.